As far as the evolution of surgery and acceleration of its knowledge and practice and experience goes, after the Napoleonic Wars, one has to say that although there were some amazing developments made, a lot of them were not acted upon, unfortunately. So if we go much later to the Crimean War, for example, we see that very few of the messages that came out of the Napoleonic Wars were remembered or practiced. And it's always a problem with surgery and warfare, that once intense warfare is over, the experience goes away and the training goes away and lessons are forgotten. I think the first significant development in surgery, and which the war ending more or less at Waterloo, was surgical adaptation to the military. When surgeons join the army, they have to go under discipline. They often had to work under unhygienic and difficult conditions. They had no authority over the commanding officer. They had to learn how to deal with untidy, dirty, mangled limbs and wounds and understand when surgery was appropriate. If it was done too soon, the patient would die of hypovolemic shock. If it was done too late, infection would set in and he'd missed his chance. So timing of surgery and learning to be a military surgeon was perhaps the first big lesson. Then secondly, this system of frontline care introduced by Larrey, which we did not emulate but were very interested in. And after the war, unfortunately, the Parliament and the British government and the Army Medical Department, through parsimony and inertia after such a long war, did not instigate, unfortunately. The spread of sepsis was understood. It was still thought from mid-18th century or beginning of the 18th century to be something in the air that spread from patient to patient. And this is an old concept, but of course we know now, following Pasteur's discovery of bacteria and Lister's work on antisepsis, that it was a bacterial spread. The spread of sepsis along blood vessels, lymphatics, tissues and veins was understood, and people obviously knew there was something taking infection from one patient to another. They observed that patients dressed by junior doctors who had fresh wounds were contaminated by those who the dresser had previously treated who had infected wounds. Fasciotomy, or the release of tight tissue tension in a limb. Tight tissue tension can compress arteries, and you need oxygen for your tissues and you need arterial blood supply to do that. If your tissue tension gets enormous with swelling and edema, then you have to cut the tissues to release that tension. Also, splinting of fractures. Unfortunately, during this war, most splints were far too short and gross deformity would occur after fractured limbs. Not only did they have to put up with the chronic osteomyelitis, which we've previously discussed, but also deformity. Another battlefield development that was interesting was the control of hemorrhage. It's interesting that in the war in Afghanistan recently, an American paper has said that if you supply American servicemen with sufficient tourniquets, even on each limb, you can reduce battlefield on-site mortality from hemorrhage by 30%. So this is still an important issue, to control hemorrhage at the site of damage. And tourniquets were used. Petit, Louis Petit in 1719, invented a screw tourniquet which was used to tighten up on the limb prior to amputation to prevent bleeding. And also a surgeon called Guthrie, George James Guthrie, who was our equivalent of Baron Larrey in the French army, used to control hemorrhage by direct digital pressure. He just put his thumb on a blood vessel. And so skilled was he that to amputate an arm, he could compress the artery with his left hand of the patient's right arm and divide the skin and bone with his right hand. So gentle control of hemorrhage in general, was another important development. Lastly, I think, is statistics. During the Peninsular War from 1808 to 1814, George James Guthrie and others developed a system of statistics, which Marshall, another famous military statistician, would take on after the war. And then we can know the mortality rates, the rate of injury, sometimes the complications, and the site of injury and wounding, which gives us, as historians, an interesting insight into battlefield damage. But I think, really, looking back on this whole war, which ended with Waterloo, we have to say that this was the beginning of military surgery. This is where surgery on the battlefield was in its ascendancy. Perhaps it's one of the reasons why we as British surgeons call ourselves Mr. and not Doctor. We're the only country in the world to do that. And the reason is for the ascendancy of surgery at these times in comparison to medicine and the treatment of disease, which still remained fairly primitive at the end of these wars. At the end of the Napoleonic Wars, publications and papers began to proliferate, and books were written by some of the famous people we've mentioned, George James Guthrie, Larrey, a surgeon named John Hennon. They all wrote extremely incisive accounts of surgery and their experiences. And in 1804, long before the war ended, the Edinburgh Medical Journal was first published. And The Lancet, edited by Thomas Wackley, was first published in 1823. After the war, obviously the examinations for military surgeons dropped, and examinations and training for general practitioners and hospital doctors became much more regulated by the Medical Act of 1815. And in 1832, to better the study of anatomy, the Anatomy Act was introduced. Prior to this, grave robbing, or digging up dead bodies in churchyards, was a common practice. Not a capital offence, one has to say, but there were rival gangs, often of ex-servicemen, who would have to deliver fresh bodies to the extramural schools of anatomy for dissection. Perhaps the most notorious of these was Robert Knox's involvement with Burke and Hare, the murderers who provide murdered victims for Knox's Edinburgh Anatomy School. Interestingly, Robert Knox was an assistant surgeon at Waterloo. So the study of anatomy became regulated. This Act of Parliament dictated that people who had no relatives were entitled to be dissected. Dissection was allowed with consent, and so forth. But surely the most important development in medicine prior to surgery, prior to 1848, was the introduction of anaesthesia. Humphrey Davy had observed the anaesthetic effect of nitrous oxide, and Horace Wells had experimented with nitrous oxide, and William Morton had, a dentist in America, had successfully extracted a tooth under nitrous oxide. The famous event took place in 1846 in Massachusetts, in the USA, in October 1846, when William Morton decided to administer ether for John Warren to remove a lump in the neck of a young man. And although very nervous about the possibility of failure, Morton's ether anaesthetic, delivered from a glass container with ether administered over a sponge, was inhaled by the patient, who was quite insensible and didn't feel the operation at all, and was quite amazed to wake up to find the operation had been done despite considerable bleeding from the wound, which was controlled. And Warren looked up and he said, "Gentlemen, this is no humbug." In other words, they had really discovered how to carry out painless surgery. And this Yankee Dodge, as Liston, famous surgeon Liston, called it, came over in 1846 in December and was obviously an instant success. Ether was soon replaced by chloroform, promoted by James Young Simpson of Edinburgh, a gynecologist there. And surgery could now take longer, expand, specialise, although there were considerable dangers with anaesthetics at this time, and in fact the first war in which anaesthesia was used was the Crimean War, the Battle of the Alma, in the autumn of 1854. Local anaesthetics were started by Karl Koller, he was an ophthalmologist, using cocaine in the eye, and soon pilocaine and other primitive local anaesthetics were employed. Lignocaine, commonly used local anaesthetic today, came in 1943. At the end of this period of revolution, we have an idea how to carry out painless surgery, and surgery can now start taking off, because the beginning of the 1800s was surely the beginning of the century of scientific discovery, and many further important inventions would take off after 1850. The mass casualties of the First War were anticipated by the formation of the Royal Army Medical Corps.